they discovered that these cells were amazing because these different place fields weren't just randomly assigned, but they would fire on this really beautiful, regular grid. I think that the crispest ideas from AI have not been anything to do with neuroscience, but the biggest intellectual leaps in terms of the inspiration often have.
This is Brain Inspired.
Hey everyone, this is Paul Middlebrooks, forging ahead here on the path for us all to understand brain and machine intelligence just a little bit better. Today I bring you Tim Behrens, a professor at the University of Oxford. Tim is a neuroscientist with a background in anatomy, all kinds of decision making. He's worked a lot on techniques to analyze fMRI data, and a lot of his work involves putting people in fMRI scanners while they perform cognitive tasks. So, and he works on many things higher cognition, including what we talk about today, how objects in our mind form relationships. This concept of forming pathways in our minds among abstract concepts sprang forth partly from earlier work on how a host of neuron types in our hippocampus and entorhinal cortex might form the basis for spatial maps in our head that we use to navigate the physical world. So maps among abstract concepts or maps among physical locations, these functions are collectively called cognitive maps. It's a term used as early as the 1940s when Edward Tolman was doing experiments and writing about cognitive maps, what they are, how they're useful, etc. And you may recall in earlier episodes, like really early on with Blake Porter, or more recently when I interviewed Jeff Hawkins, when we've talked about place cells and grid cells in the entorhinal cortex and hippocampus. But today we really hash out that story a bit more. We talk about grid cells and how the neuroscience of spatial navigation came about, and Tim really tells that story. And we talk about how Tim came to think that those same grid cell-like codes could be used for navigating the abstract concepts that we have in our heads. And we touch on the role of bottom-up data-driven neuroscience versus top-down theory-driven neuroscience, which is a theme that we'll return to a week from now when I speak with John Krakauer in the next episode. And of course, I bring it to AI and how Tim's work might relate to artificial intelligence. There is a lot that we don't get to that he's working on, like he has recent work on intuitive planning and hippocampal replay in hippocampal neural circuits. So I'll leave that to you to learn more about. Quote of the show today by Tim out of nowhere. The quote is, "There was a tension for the soul of psychology." Now, come on. What other show are you going to hear that just manifest in a conversation? Okay, show notes are at braininspired.co/podcast/24. Please consider supporting the show on Patreon for the tiny amount of $2 or $4 per month. You can find the red Patreon button at braininspired.co. Thanks this week to Vivek and Martin, the latest beautiful souls out there giving to the cause. And thanks to the rest of you already supporting this podcast. You guys are awesome. You may have noticed I took a brief hiatus because of the chaos of the holidays, but I am back and I have a bunch of guests lined up in the next few weeks. So thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting the show. And I hope that your new year is going outrageously well so far. All right. I hope you enjoy and learn something new and fun from my conversation with Tim. Timothy, Edward, John, Behrens, thank you for being here and welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me. It's a fun podcast.
So I will have introduced you, sort of a lot of your background, because you've done a lot of varied kinds of work. But you're currently a professor of computational neuroscience at the University of Oxford. And as far as I can tell, you were born in the Oxford buildings. Is that right?
I've been here a while. I was certainly an undergraduate in the Oxford buildings. I've been here since I was 18. But I also have an honorary position at University College London in the Wellcome Centre there. So I spend about 3 days of my week in Oxford and about 2 days of my week at UCL.
Okay, good. So they do let you leave the building there. So that's good. So, like I said, I will have introduced you, but you have kind of a long academic career of studying various kinds of decision-making under various modalities, and you've worked a lot with fMRI and techniques to analyze that sluggish signal we call fMRI, and lots more. But recently, you have become interested in the structure or relations between concepts in our mind, part of what's called a cognitive map. So today, we're going to talk about your recent work in that vein.
Somehow, I've always been interested in this, in something a bit like that. It's not... I think I've always, even the works I did in decision making and reinforcement learning, which I see as part of the same thing.
Yeah.
I was always interested in how we build models of the world there in terms of, so for example, how fast we learn. I made arguments about how you needed models of how fast, models of the temporal dynamics of the world in order to know how fast to learn. And I made arguments about how you need models of the relationships between things in order to know how to make decisions. And so it is true that it's more explicit in my more recent work, but essentially there are two parts of my work, but it's not really those two. So I mean, historically, I've done a lot of work on anatomy and brain connections mm-hmm. in a number of species, and that is quite separate from the work on learning and I guess what you might call cognition. But a lot of the work in cognition is really just about how the brain goes about building models of the world and when does it need to. That's somehow what I've always worked on that side of my work. And the stuff that you're referring to, which is about grid cells, is perhaps the most explicit example of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Very good. Okay. Well, we're going to talk about those grid cells and the fallout thereof here. So you recently published this paper called "What is a Cognitive Map? Organizing Knowledge for Flexible Behavior," which describes how grid cell-like codes in the frontal cortex might be a mechanism by which we associate and navigate among abstract concepts. We're going to buttress that also with your recent science paper before that in 2016 called Organizing Conceptual Knowledge in Humans mm-hmm. with a Grid-like Code. And in that, you demonstrate this by having people stretch out and squash up the necks and legs of birds, which is quite a cruel experiment, my friend. You really have a macabre streak in you, don't you?
I don't know. I think that maybe it was my friend and colleague Jill O'Reilly, and together with our PhD student Alexa Constantinescu, who came up with the particularity of the bird torturing.
They despise the birds, yes.
But it is, it was just once you're looking for two abstract dimensions, we thought we may as well choose fun ones.
Okay, good. And who knows, if we get to it, we may touch on some of your latest work on intuitive planning, which is one way that all of this could work as well.
Yeah, and there's also, we've also got some stuff in review about replay, which is fun.
Oh, cool. Okay. Well, so there's a lot we could talk about, obviously, but so let's start in the 1940s, which is a great place to always start, right? Let's start with Edward Tolman. Maybe you could just describe the origins of the term cognitive map and the concept of a cognitive map.
Yeah, so there was a tension for the soul of psychology that lasted from through Pavlov and Thorndike and Skinner on one arm of the game against people who thought that there was more to life and intelligence than reinforcement.
So it's the behaviorists against the rest.
Yeah, the cognitivists.
The cognitivists.
I guess you want to call it that. Yeah. And I guess Tolman was the most prominent or early one of these cognitivists. And so he was trying to counter the argument that everything was done through reinforcement. And he did so with a beautiful set of experiments showing that animals had detailed knowledge of what you might call a map, so of the relationship between places in a maze, for example. And so there would be The ones that make it so that make it most obvious, I think, are experiments like if you let an animal run around a maze for a long time before ever putting a reward in the maze, then the moment you put that reward in the maze, they're much, much, much faster to return to that reward than if you'd put them naively in that maze for the first time with the reward. And so they'd learned something about the maze before there was any reward in there. They'd learned implicitly about all the relationships between it. They learned how to navigate the maze before there was any rewards in the maze, just in that exploration.
And they would, apparently they would learn shortcuts in the mazes as well, right?
So they would learn to take shortcuts. So they would take shortcuts, right? So you could, so there were like classic experiments with shortcuts and blocking arms. So for like you can allow an animal to run around a maze, and then you can put a reward at one place, and then start them at another place again and again and again. So they become really reinforced on that particular activity of going from place A to place B. Mm-hmm. And then you think, okay, that's what they're learning. They're learning by reinforcement how to get from place A to place B. But then if you block that route, then Tolman showed that they had no problem in finding some new route that had never been reinforced.
Ah, I see.
Yeah, exactly. Or equivalently, if you train them on the long route and then open up a new shortcut, open up an arm that they've never been reinforced on. Obviously, they've experienced it beforehand, when before the reinforcer was there. But if you then just open that arm up, then they will be able to take that go find their reward. They know the map, the plan of how things are related to each other, and how different routes lead to the same thing. And they're able to use that information in determining their behavior, even when those particular relations have never been reinforced.
Yeah.
And Tolman obviously was playing with spatial experiments in rodents, but he definitely believed that this idea of cognitive map would generalize to explain an awful lot of our cognition. That's what he believed, across domains of social neuroscience, across abstract thought. He certainly wasn't making arguments just about space.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, the experiments were definitely about space, but I guess he had a larger picture in mind, like you said, which he called a cognitive map.
Which is understanding all the relationships between, having a model of how different things relate to each other in your world, and being able to use that model to find effectively shortcuts in abstract spaces, understand the relation. I mean, the things that are, if you're trying to define why a cognitive map is useful to you, the two biggest ones are these ideas of shortcuts. So if you discover something after a long, torturous set of actions, if you understand something about those actions, you might be able to realize there was a quicker way to achieve your goal, which is something that you, so it's like a shortcut in abstract space. Or the other thing you can do is if you've got a cognitive map and you know the relationship between all the things in the world, is you can do you can make rich inferences from very little data. You can understand that if something happens to one thing, it might have big consequences on some other part of your cognitive map, because you know the relationships in the cognitive map. And I gave a bunch of examples of that in that paper that you described.
Okay, so thanks for the description for what a cognitive map is. However, fast forward in time, and the experiments were originally done in spatial navigation settings, and along come place cells and grid cells and the hippocampal zoo, as it's called, all these different cells that contribute to spatial navigation. So we've talked about that a little bit on the show, but it'd be nice to sort of unravel it and just talk about the story of grid cells and spatial navigation to set up the transition to what you're doing these days. So maybe we can just trace the story of grid cells in the 2D spatial navigation plane.
Well, you start with place cells, I guess, with John O'Keefe, Nadel and Keefe in the 70s, making arguments about what hippocampal cells were doing. And they found hippocampal cells had these really beautiful spatial response fields. So they would fire. Your listeners should imagine a rat running around, but now instead of a maze, he's running around in a square arena about a meter by a meter. And
that's 3 feet, folks. 3 feet for my English listening audience. My Americans, yeah. Sorry.
For your American audience.
Yeah.
Europeans understand meters.
I know. We should, but yeah.
Yeah, and so then these cells in the hippocampus would fire at very particular points in these in this arena. So it might fire 20 centimeters away from the left wall and 30 away from the bottom wall of this arena. And then it would obviously have a field, so that would be where its peak was, and it would fire less and less around there, but it would only fire in a very circumscribed part of this arena. And there were these there's a huge argument in the 70s about whether they were really coding place or what were they coding. And to some extent, that's still an interesting argument. But O'Keefe managed to convince people that, for example, it wasn't caused by the fact that it smelled different there, or the fact that they were looking at a different thing in that place than the other place. And some of the key features of these cells, they're very impressive. They generalized over which direction the rodent is looking, and they generalize over how fast he's running and those kinds of things. So it's unlikely to be a sensory or a motor thing that's causing those things. Mm-hmm. And O'Keefe made these arguments throughout the 70s and called it a basis for a cognitive map. And it was easy to imagine why it was called a map, because it was really spatial.
Yeah.
It's interesting also to note that Edwin Rolls at the same time was recording in monkey hippocampus, and he was recording some or maybe a little bit later, but not much, was recording things that didn't look spatial, right? So, his monkeys were hanging out in cages and walking around space, and the cells there did not seem to care particularly where the monkey was, but cared an awful lot more, for example, about what the monkey was looking at, the gaze direction, or where it was attending, and those kinds of things. And so that already raises the possibility that in an animal that can move its focus of attention to somewhere else, because a rodent is probably, at least when it's running along, the most important thing in that rodent's life is where it is. But a monkey sitting up a tree with his excellent vision can be going, oh, there's an apple over there. So it's already interesting to note that it might not be just about where you are, but rather what's important in terms of it's an interesting representation of maybe what's relevant to you right now, whereas and in a rodent, what's relevant to him right now might be just where he is.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's also, maybe this is a time to note that the hippocampal structure, including the hippocampus and entorhinal cortex, it's often noted that they're not close to sensory areas, right? So they're kind of deep in the pathway of your cortical brain, right? So it would make sense if what's being encoded there are a bit more, could be a bit more abstract than just where you are, for instance, and could code for such things.
Well, there's several things to say about that. Where you are is a very abstract thing.
Sure.
It's really difficult to get, imagine all of what you have to do to get something from your retina, a code from your retina, some light from retina, which is changes depending on the lighting conditions or depending on the particular head direction that you're looking in. So, and is also egocentric, right? Depends entirely on your visual code, depends on where you're looking in terms of your own body orientation, not in terms of the coordinate frame of the arena.
Right.
Changing that into what we call an allocentric code, which is a code which on an XY plane where you actually are, this is an extraordinarily abstract. I think that this word abstract, the reason you're calling it not abstract is because it's so easy for you to know what it is. But I think the computations to get to allocentric position from the retina and the movement of your legs are far from trivial.
No, I'm not denigrating the computational feats of doing that. I'm just saying that, and the point has been made before, that type of machinery could be used for other processes as well, which is actually what a bit about what you do, we're going to talk about.
Yeah, I think the other thing to say about the hippocampus is that despite this, there's been a big focus on space in the rodent hippocampal community, which is famous and has been made particularly famous by the Nobel Prize being awarded to it.
Right.
But it's also true that the hippocampus is notorious for being important for memory, and that memory doesn't have to be about space. I mean, who knows whether it will or not, but there's no question that someone should have given Brenda Milner a Nobel Prize for that discovery.
Right.
And it is...
Just to be clear, we should say you're talking about patient HEM and other studies about episodic memory and the memory deficits associated with lesions in hippocampal structures.
And Alzheimer's disease. I mean, Alzheimer's disease affects, it makes it difficult to find your keys if you've got Alzheimer's disease, but so if you've lost your car keys, you probably won't know where they are in space, but it affects an awful lot of other things about your memory as well, your episodic memory. And certainly the most noticeable thing for somebody with a hippocampal lesion is nothing to do with space. The most noticeable thing is to do with much more abstract, the memory for much more abstract cognitive things, like just the memory of having met Brenda Milner yesterday was the yeah. most noticeable thing, the HM deficit. So whilst all these amazing things have happened in space in terms of neuron representation, nobody was ever kidded that the hippocampus was really all about space.
I heard Edvard Moser, I think, talking about the current conception and consensus, or almost consensus, about the hippocampal formation or complex, that it does encode spatial navigation, but with things like episodic memory on top of it, right? So
that's one view. So let's argue that the hippocampus is a memory system. Then you have to start figuring out what a memory is or what an experience is. And there's no question that space and time, which are often found in hippocampal representations, are two really important components of memory. There's no question that those two things are really important components of memory. You remember where you are and roughly what was happening around then. But there are loads of other really important components of memory. And you might argue that the space and time are a fundamental framework upon which other things are built. Or you might argue they're two components of memory. I don't think there's any hard evidence to separate out those two arguments right now.
Okay, well, we could go off the rails here with just the hippocampus, which would be
right.
fun.
Anyway.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah. So getting back to the actual spatial navigation story that brought all
this
about.
Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah.
So you have these place cells, which, you know, and then O'Keefe writes this book called Hippocampus as a Cognitive Map, right, after this all this place cell work.
Mm-hmm.
And then... What, 30 years later, it took 30 years for...
2006,
For Maybrit Moser and Edvard Moser and their colleagues to record what are called grid cells in entorhinal cortex. And I know it wasn't that straightforward, but maybe you can kind of talk about grid cells now.
Sure. So this is another amazing discovery. So entorhinal cortex is the input from to hippocampus.
Major input, right?
Yeah, it's the major input. If you look in the textbooks, it's the only cortical input into hippocampus, I think. Mm. But in those textbooks, that's no longer thought to be quite true. But it's certainly by far the dominant input into hippocampus. And so they, Edvard and Maybrit were interested in how you could make such a thing as a place cell. They were interested in these complicated computations that I was referring to before. How do you get something that starts off in your retinal space and build something that ends up being an allocentric place cell?
Right. Well, because there was this sort of, not controversy, but it was unknown whether place cells on their own could encode the spatial navigation or whether they are the downstream cells of other computations. So
I think maybe that's right. Maybe people thought that at the time. I think that now people would definitely say that. But I mean, I think that really Edvard and Maybrit were just really interested in how you could get something as abstract as an allocentric place cell from, and so they thought the thing to do would be to go and record in the structure that's one synapse upstream from the hippocampus. And so they went and recorded in the entorhinal cortex, and they recorded lots of interesting patterns there that seemed odd. in that they would have more than one field. they would be like place cells, but they would have more than one field. And then, and this, it's, it all seemed a bit confusing until they made the arena bigger. When they made the arena bigger, they discovered that these cells were amazing because these different place fields weren't just randomly assigned, but they would fire on this really beautiful regular grid. And this grid is like a triangular lattice. And so it's like, if you can imagine equilateral triangles all stacked next to each other. And if you stack enough of them around a central thing, you get a hexagon.
Yeah.
And so this triangular or hexagonal lattice was beautifully recapitulated in the firing fields of these cells, which were clearly coding place, but they were coding multiple places.
Mm-hmm.
And those multiple places would lie on this beautiful triangular lattice.
So just to be crystal clear, the rat would start at one place. It would run about, let's say half a meter, right? In one direction, and a cell would fire, and it could run half a meter back to where it was before, and another, that cell would fire again. And then they could run equilateral triangles all over the field, and that same cell would fire over and over.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And so in the, where they were recording to start with, so these cells would have a period of maybe 30 centimeters. So if you're in a 80 centimeter arena, which they were, then you may get two or three of these things, of these place fields, and you can't quite see where they are. But if you make the arena a meter and a half, then you're going to get lots of these fields. And then you start to see what it looks like. And it actually turns out that if you just move the electrodes more dorsal to somewhere to somewhere a little bit further up the entorhinal cortex, now the field size reduces, and so that the field spacing reduces. And so now there are ones that maybe have a 15 centimeter period or something like that. And then they are really, really tiling it in this wonderfully beautiful triangular grid.
So exactly. It's maps at multiple scales.
Yeah.
Great. And they call these grid cells.
They called them grid cells. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so there's the reason they thought that was interesting. I mean, apart from being interesting because of its beauty,
right?
It's very rare you see something that beautiful when looking at neurons. Those neurons have interesting mathematical properties, but they also, because they fire on this regularly spaced grid, the first thing that Moses thought, I think, when they saw these cells was that they would give it allow you to compute a metric for space so that you knew how far that you'd run in any one direction.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know how far you've run, then that's obviously an important component to knowing where you are. And then that is an important building block for a place cell.
Yeah. Okay. So then you have place cells and you have grid cells, and what's called the hippocampal zoo, there's all sorts of cells in there, direction cells, social place cells, border cells, object vector cells, reward cells, goal direction cells. I'm sure there are more than I'm missing. But so this work culminated in the 2014 Nobel Prize, which was shared among John O'Keefe and May Britt Moser and Edvard Moser. So that's kind of the story of the discovery of spatial navigation in the hippocampus. And there's actually still lots to learn in that vein as well. So how grid cells accomplish that. There's not a totally satisfactory model yet. The book's not closed on it, although many have been proposed, right? And are in the works.
I'd like go much, much further than what you're saying now. Uh-huh. I'd say we know very little about spatial navigation.
Yeah, I hate that. Every time anytime we talk about what we know about in the brain, it's always very, very little. You know,
we know an awful lot about how you might navigate an open 1 meter in arena.
Yeah.
But that's not what rodents do in the wild. They build extraordinary complicated spatial burrows. They
three-dimensional.
They can navigate.
Yeah.
They can navigate around all sorts of very vast complicated maps, and really, we have little idea how that works, how you could effectively control your behavior in those worlds, which are not open 1 meter environments is the subject of as much mystery as abstract representations are, I think.
You know, this is maybe we can chat about this for a second right now. A lot of people I've had on my podcast, and it just seems recently in the world of models that there's this really big push to come at neuroscience with theoretical claims and then test them experimentally. And we don't know anything about the brain. We got to come with theory first. And this is one instance, and correct me if I'm wrong, where it was more experimental ground up, right, from the beginning, like the discovery of the place cells and then the searching for the grid cells. So there's theory coming in, but it didn't start with theory. And so this siren call right now with deep learning, especially to look for the algorithms and then try to figure out how it works in the brain, this is one minor victory, I suppose, for the lowly experimentalist searching for things. Do you think that there's any merit to that?
Yeah, yeah. I almost don't think there's anything we've ever discovered that started with theory. Is that right? I think that most things start with some data, and then you need some theory to explain that data, to explain what would be interesting to look for next, and then you need some more data to see if that theory was right, and then it's like a cycle. But the start of that cycle is data.
Well, we are data. We have to be. We are the data. We have to be the start, I suppose. But
you're right that the hippocampus is an extreme example of that, because the data seem so intuitively understandable without the theory.
Without the theory.
Mm-hmm. And it's also so beautifully structured without the theory. I mean, I think there is a huge amount of theory that, I do theory. I mean, I think there's a huge amount that theory can add to that hippocampal story, and we're trying to do so. But place cells came before theory, grid cells came before theory. Actually, theory then predicted the existence of these things, of these boundary and boundary vector cells before they were seen. That was my friend Neil Burgess predicted they would be there from a beautiful couple of theoretical papers. But the other thing that has been so beautiful in the hippocampal field is this phenomenon called hippocampal replay, which happens in the shortwave ripples, which is like you can watch the hippocampus dreaming, basically. You can watch it. You can watch what the animal's thinking about.
Yeah.
There's a huge amount of structure in that data, which is just stunning. And that has come before any theory. People are just starting to think about theories of replay now.
Yeah.
And so it's like being one thing after another, which has been pleasant surprises from the hippocampus. Yeah, even before that, HM was a pleasant surprise for the hippocampal people, if not for himself.
Right, right. Yeah, there was no theory for Phineas Gage either, I suppose. All his patients. Well, okay. So
it just must be true, right? So like, it's true in V1 as well, right? So Hubel and Wiesel came before there was any theory to explain why the Gabor filters are there. I mean, now there are 10, 15 different theories for why you have those Gabor filters. But like, the people who are developing these theories, there's so many possible theories. The people when Alhafsen and Fields were looking at sparse coding in visual cortex, if those sparse codes hadn't predicted Gabor filters, they wouldn't have known whether they were on the right track or not.
Right.
Same thing with Rao and Ballard when they were looking at predictive coding. And now the people who are looking at ConvNets to do those same things have a similar game in the later visual cortices, or Doris Tsao's beautiful work on the face patches, trying to understand them with these PCA like codes. Those things, there's just no point starting with that theory until the data is there. If you're looking at theories, if you're talking about theories of representation, which I think that's what you're talking about, right?
Well, and who would have thought? I mean, so a triangle is a beautiful geometric shape, right? But how would anyone have predicted that grid cells would be laid out in these hexagonal structures without actually finding it? You know, because they could be laid out in any structure or.
Well, they could. That happens to be the mathematics. So you could, if somebody had said, what is the most efficient way to index memories, to build an index for memories, which gives a metric structure for space, then maybe a mathematician would have come back and said grid cells, right? But nobody knew there were going to be cells there that were building this metric, this metric for the spatial for the spatial place cells. Yeah, exactly.
So hexagons seem to be special then, in a mathematical sense. I mean, are they? Do we see hexagonal structure throughout the animal kingdom? Is this a common motif in all animals? Do we know how prevalent hexagonal structures are, brain computations?
We know that that's the most efficient way of packing space in two dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to place Gaussian place fields that are going to inhibit each other, so which is basically what all the models of the attractor models of grid cells look like. If you want to place a bunch of Gaussian place fields that will inhibit each other on a 2D plane, then they'll naturally come out hexagonal, because that's the most efficient way of them packing together. Yeah, if you want to pack apples in a crate, you do so with hexagonal packing. It's the most efficient way to pack spheres or Gaussians or that kind of thing.
Mm.
Yeah, so it's the most efficient way to pack spheres. It's the most efficient way to pack place fields. And so I guess the early people that saw them and said, oh, yeah, of course, that's the most efficient way to pack place fields. And in hindsight, it was obvious, but I bet there was nobody thinking about it in foresight.
So before you were stretching and squashing bird necks and legs, people were put into an fMRI scanner and asked to navigate in virtual reality worlds.
That's definitely true. That work was often done by Neil Burgess and colleagues.
Yeah, and so what would happen is this hexagonal structure would be recapitulated, would be found in the fMRI data in mm-hmm. hippocampal structures. And I guess did they find it in prefrontal cortical structures as well at the time?
Yeah. So they found it in medial frontal cortex, medial parietal cortex, and entorhinal cortex. Yeah, so that was amazing to be able to see grid cell-like activity. There's an interesting trick that I didn't mention before, which lets you see it with fMRI, which is that all of those triangular lattices are aligned with each other in terms of the sort of, if you can imagine a triangle, it has some angle to the edge of the arena. That's called the grid angle.
Mm.
And that those grid angles are basically shared amongst all the grid cells. And so it turns out that if you run along that grid angle or any direction that's a multiple of 60 degrees away from that grid angle, so 60 degrees is the angle that defines the equilateral triangle. If you're running along any of those directions, there's more activity than there is if you're running at one of the intermediary directions that isn't 60 degrees away from the grid angle.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get this signal called this hexadirectional signal, so which is big along any of the grid angles, but small in between any of the grid angles. So that was found by Christian Duller and Neil Burgess in the 2010 Nature paper, and they showed that was true in entorhinal cortex, but also in medial frontal and medial parietal, which suggests something pretty incredible, which is that these grid cells might be not just entorhinal cortex in humans, but also in a much broader parts of frontal and parietal cortices. Those cortices actually are strongly part of the hippocampal network as well as entorhinal cortex. There's a big output regions of hippocampus, and then there are just one synapse away from hippocampus in terms of the input. One extra synapse, they've got big inputs to entorhinal and big inputs to nucleus reunions, which allow them to communicate with hippocampus very, very closely. They often oscillate in phase with hippocampus in like resting state fMRI, for example, or if you put a electrode in both places. I don't know if that's interesting or not. But anyway, what is interesting is that this fMRI signal, which seems indirect to people who are used to recording cells, had made a prediction that in humans, at least, you would find grid-like activity in these regions that were not entorhinal cortex. That turned out to be true. So Josh Jacobs and Itzhak Frieg were doing these very similar experiments in epileptic patients who have electrodes in medial frontal cortex, medial parietal cortex, and entorhinal cortex, and found grid cells in all of those places, which is kind of awesome, right? So it's kind of awesome when something as indirect as fMRI is making a prediction about what the representation is going to be.
Right. Okay, so then I'm not sure if this is what really spurred you into thinking about pursuing this with the bird experiment. So why would we think that spatial navigation would generalize to concept navigation? We're about to talk about your bird experiment, and then we'll get into more broadly concepts of a cognitive map. but is it just the mathematical beauty and efficiency of the hexagonal kind of code that we'd think, well, this must just generalize, the spatial kind of patterning must generalize to abstract concepts as well?
No, I think that there's an awful lot of power in thinking about generalizations and analogies. And I think that in general, it is true that where they are available, our brain is extraordinarily powerful at taking advantage of them, much more so than any artificial intelligence that's been invented yet. And so it wasn't surprising to me that, so it seemed like it was possible that, that it would happen. But that's not why I did this study. I did the study because there were grid cells in those brain regions that are the brain regions that are are important in. So those brain regions that are not the entorhinal cortex where there were grid cells, those brain regions are important for building these abstract models of the world in general. When you look for studies of things like acquired equivalence, right, in rodents, where two things become related to each other because like if A predicts reward and B some reward and B predicts some reward but C predicts some different reward, then the representations of A and B will become more similar in medial frontal cortex. They've acquired this equivalence between them, so they are understanding the relationship between these different stimuli because they both predict the same thing, for example. So that's in really basic rodent studies, but also in human studies. Whenever you do these types of decision-making studies, which require things that are more simple than just repeating reward, that are much more sort of Tolman-like in their structure, it's those brain regions that seem to be the ones that are most important for making those decisions. So, and I was studying value, and I was studying how the roles of those brain regions, the computational roles of those brain regions in decision making. And at the time, a lot of people were interested in their roles of computing values from those world structures. Mm-hmm. But nobody knew what the representations of those world structures was. And it seemed to me to be really important to know that. And so I had a bunch of studies trying to get at that in different ways. And so I studied strange things like how you could represent or predict what it would be like to eat tea jelly. If you knew what it was like to eat tea and jelly, you knew how do you combine these things together?
Yeah.
What does the neural representation look like? I did that kind of study. And I was really at the time extremely interested in how those brain regions were representing the world so that you could make decisions about them and use them to control your behavior. And then I saw that there were grid cells in those regions, and I just thought, well, fuck me, if there are grid cells in those regions and those are the regions that are representing these abstract world models, let's see if those same cells are representing abstract world models as are representing spatial world models.
Yeah.
And so I'll stop talking in a second, but I think there's something interesting there. For me, this has happened before, but often computational people are very dismissive of the idea that knowing where something happens is important in the brain. But it is. I mean, like the brain is functionally localized. And so for me, the only reason why I was able to make what might be some kind of conceptual insight into how something happens was because I saw that two different things happened in the same place in the brain.
Yeah, I'd forgotten you started your career off in phrenology, so that was that would make. But you mentioned,
but I mean, it is so easily dismissed, but people, I mean, people forget how people forget all the early experiments by Lashley where he just thought the brain was a soup and started cutting bits out randomly. But there is something important about where something happens in the brain as well as what happens.
Yeah, you mentioned. That the brain, if there's a useful way to do things, the brain will use it, right? So there's a few people, some people like Rudolfo Llinás, who wrote Eye of the Vortex, people like Daniel Wolpert, who you can look up his TED Talks and stuff, and other people have talked about how, or have suggested that evolutionarily, movement is the central function of the brain. And that through evolution, movement processing has internalized and become thoughts, essentially, right? And in that sense, thoughts are a form of movement. And so this kind of, if there was a spatial navigation evolutionarily to begin with, if there's merit to this idea, you know, and that's coded in the hippocampus and then things become layered or wherever it's coded, and then things become internalized and layered in that sense, it makes a lot of sense evolutionarily to use this same code in other parts of the brain and for other cognitive processes. I don't know if you have thoughts about that, but.
Maybe. I mean, yeah. So, I mean, that might be right. Or it might be that we have. Yeah. So there are like I don't know the answer to this question.
Yeah.
It's philosophy as much as it is science.
Right.
And I'm not very good at philosophy, but the we don't even know if it's the same cells. Right. We don't know whether the grid cells in the abstract space are the same ones as spatial ones. It's completely possible. Like there have been these nice demonstrations that you can get grid cells by just doing a PCA of your experiences, right? And there's plenty of evidence that neural circuits can do PCAs. Maybe my subjects that had a bunch of experiences with these stretchy birds for hours, and then over when they were sleeping, the miracles of sleep did a nice PCA of their experiences, and out popped some new grid cells that were never there for space. I don't know the answer. I don't know whether that's true or not.
Yeah.
I mean, that. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, so we come to your barbaric bird experiment. So maybe you can just really briefly walk us through what you actually did, not that you were pulling and pushing on actual birds, and just what you found.
So I've just been explaining that Neil and Christian found this hexadirectional signal, this signal which changes depending on whether you're running along the grid angle or across the grid angle. And that's like running in virtual reality, in a two-dimensional virtual reality. And we had thought, for reasons that I've just mentioned, a similar representation might be true for more abstract models of the world. And so we needed a model of the world where we could, which was amenable to this particular fMRI measurement, which is a measurement that we can make of grid cells in humans. And so we needed a two-dimensional model of the abstract model of the world. And so we needed some stimuli which could vary in two dimensions. And so we could have picked any stimuli that varied in two dimensions.
But you went to the pub and you thought.
Yeah, well, actually, I don't know how it happened, but maybe Alexa and I were discussing a paper of Russ Poldrack's where he had some birds where he'd changed the angle of the neck or something like that. Yeah, I don't think any idea has ever come to you in a pub without seeing stuff before. Yeah, I think that I can't quite remember how who had the idea or where it came from, but it seemed silly given that we were just looking for two dimensions. It seemed like we should choose some ones that would be interesting or fun, and so we thought of using these bird stimuli. I think it was related to Russ Poldrack's got a paper with some bird stimuli, and maybe we'd just seen that in a lab meeting or something.
Yeah,
and so we thought, okay, cool, we'll use these bird stimuli, and then. But then in order to get this measurement to work, we couldn't just have the stimuli. We had to have, imagine you were moving in this two-dimensional space, right? So if you imagine the physical experiment, the physical real-world experiment, it depended on the direction of movement, not on the place. And so in the analogy for non-spatial dimensions, you'd have to change from having one neck length to having another in order to move in this two-dimensional space. And so the analogy for walking or running in these two dimensions is morphing or stretching the legs or the neck. So in order to get this measurement, we needed to be able to morph the neck and the leg such that the movement in this two-dimensional map subtended different angles. And so, for example, if you just move the neck, you might be moving at 0 degrees, or if you just move the legs, that's orthogonal because they're two different dimensions, so that would be 90 degrees. Mm-hmm. But if you moved the legs twice as fast as you were moving the neck, then that would be 60 degrees, et cetera, in this two-dimensional abstract map. And so we had lots of birds that are moving, that were morphing, the legs and the necks were stretching at different speeds. And so you'd have a duck turning into a swan, turning into a flamingo style thing. And you can imagine how you have to change the necks and legs to get those things to happen. And then those movements would subtend different angles in the map. The subject would never see that, but that's what the implication would be. And then we went there and tried to figure out if we could see this same hexadirectional signal in this stretching bird space. So like a morph that was at 0 degrees or would have the same signal as one that was at 60 and 120 and 180, but different from one at 30 or 90 or whatever, 90 plus 60 is 150. Yeah, and so you can get this beautiful hexadirectional symmetry in the fMRI signal. And when we found that in just exactly these same locations that Neil and Christian had found them in the fMRI, and that Josh Jacobs and Itzhak Fried had found them in the single unit recording. And we figured that was pretty unlikely to happen by chance. And so we got quite excited.
Yeah. So these are abstract bird concepts and relations, and nothing to do with physical spatial navigation. So they're navigating among these abstract concepts that they had to learn for the scanner. Okay, so you've shown then that the same kind of hexadirectional coding can be applied to these abstract concepts. Now, I had Matt Botvinnik on the show a few shows ago now.
That must have been fun.
Oh, yeah. He was a lot of fun. And we talked about his meta-reinforcement learning work a lot. So how does this grid-like cognitive map fit within that meta-reinforcement learning work? So just to recapitulate what that is, so they modeled the prefrontal cortex and the basal ganglia as this big recurrent neural network. And the signals, reinforcement learning signals from the basal ganglia would train the recurrent neural network, which was the prefrontal cortex, and it would mold and shape the weights of that network. And then they could hold those weights. They would train on a bunch of different tasks. And then they could hold those weights constant, freeze the weights. Then the learning in the prefrontal cortex would then take place among the activation dynamics, among the units in the recurrent neural network. And they saw a lot of the same things that you see experimentally when you do these tasks and record neurons. I think I summarized that okay. But anyway, so it's a reinforcement learning, it's meta-reinforcement learning. So it's a reinforcement learning system training a reinforcement learning system. And you talk about this in the paper, what is a cognitive map? So how does the idea of grid cell-like coding relate to or map onto this idea of meta-reinforcement learning?
So yeah, so that paper by Jane Wang and Zeb Kurth-Nelson and Matt Botvinnik is cool. It shows that you can learn something about the structure of the problem that you're working in, and you can use that to make learning much faster.
Yeah.
So instead of just learning, instead of just rewards causing synaptic learning, rewards can basically allow you to infer where you are somehow in the structure of the task that you're performing.
Right.
And then you can make all these kinds of cool inferences that I was talking about with cognitive maps earlier. And what they also showed beautifully is that structural knowledge that is held in what they're going to call the prefrontal cortex can itself be trained over very long time periods by rewards. So you can just build, you can just get over many, many experiences, you can build effectively a cognitive map by getting enough rewards. So that they called it meta-learning because learning the structure of the world, which is somehow a cognitive map, allowed them to learn which thing was rewarded now much faster because they knew the structure of the task or the world. So people have studied these problems in psychology for a long time. The earliest people are like Harlow, and he called it learning set. Once you know the structure of a problem, you can learn each new problem much, much faster. So the brain definitely does this. And it's really cool to show that a neural network can do it as well. It's great fun. So there are some differences between that and grid cells that are worth, I think, pointing out. So the first, simple, obvious difference is that grid cells are not trained by reward. So Matt and Zeb and Jane, in order to learn the cognitive map, they did this thing called meta-reinforcement learning, which has meant they could only learn something new about the cognitive map over very long timescales about which structure, which cognitive map predicted slightly bigger rewards over very long timescales. So it was like really an extreme version of trial and error learning. And you're not, so it's like when you're, when you walk through a new room, you will just by associating temporal sequences of associating this room followed by this corridor followed by this room, you'll be building up a map, just like Tolman's rodents, rats were to start with. But Zeb and Matt and Jane's network will not be doing that. It will only change the synaptic weights when it gets a reward. And so it has to, so obviously they could change that, and I'm sure they are doing that right now, but it's not clear what the correct algorithm for this implicit learning or learning from organizing all of that, rather than, so what effectively what they did was allow reward to organize their knowledge into what's relevant and what isn't relevant. And it's a clever idea. It's cool. Maybe there are systems in the brain that do that as well, but that's clearly not what grid cells are doing. Grid cells, as I told you at the very start of this podcast, we know all sorts of implicit knowledge about the world without ever experiencing any reward at all.
Yeah.
And so that's one thing that's clearly different about the medial temporal lobe system from the systems that they were modeling in basal ganglia and frontal cortex. But and the other sort of more obvious, sort of very clear and obvious potential difference is, of course, that we don't even know if the grid cells are learnt at all, or whether they come in those structures delivered by evolution. And so then that's more like another kind of meta-learning, which is like designing new architectures by learning new architectures in deep net, which is also a kind of meta-learning. You might argue that evolution in some way does this kind of meta-learning as well. To design the best architecture to solve spatial problems. Yeah, anyway, all those things add up to some interesting differences, but I think the biggest conceptual difference is between those types of learning of a cognitive map is that Matt and Zeb and Jane are really worried about learning from reward, whereas the hippocampus is really learning from everything.
So do you think that, do you think that the idea of the cognitive map and these hexadirectional codes will fit in with the reinforcement learning work to, so what I'm wondering is like how,
yeah, right. So the whole,
how these grid cell like codes will improve AI moving forward, essentially, you know?
I think that they, there's like a whole field of work on model-based versus model-free reinforcement learning that's where building models of the world is. So if you have a model of the world, you can do all sorts of things that you can't do without a model of the world. And it is a major topic of research at like DeepMind, for example. They have a science paper on building models of space. They have a nature paper on grid cells in spatial models. Because they realize that if you have your relational knowledge organized well, then you gain an awful lot more from each reward than you do if you don't have it organized well. You can learn much faster from much fewer data points. You can make analogies between things that are similar in some dimension. You can do this other thing that the hippocampus does, which is simulate. So you can, before you make decisions or try things out in your model. And these are all active areas of research at DeepMind, for sure, where I hang out sometimes. So for me, the essence of cognition, I'm more of a cognitivist than I am a behaviorist. I think that the essence of cognition is going to be how rich your world model is, not how many rewards you've experienced. And I think that will be true in deep networks as well as it is true in brains. I mean, basically, humans, because they can. So I guess there's three or four things that humans do really, really well that deep nets that deep nets don't do really well. I mean, there's many, but the ability to abstract, the ability to generalize, the ability to make inferences. Things that are not in your direct sensory environment all allow you to learn from dramatically less data than any deep network that we have at the moment.
So do you think that thinking about general AI, which is the goal among a lot of AI practitioners, do you think that this grid cell-like code is the missing piece, one of a few missing pieces, one of many missing pieces that could herald in, get us closer to what people would consider human level or general AI?
I don't have, nobody can answer that question, but I'm not going to argue that it's a grid cell like code, certainly. But I mean, I think that the idea of building models of the world is a really important piece in building organized, efficient models of the world is a really important piece in building more sophisticated AIs. If what you're trying to do is build a human, then you need something that has a model not only of the outside world, but also of itself. And then you get into complicated, interesting arguments about what a model of self looks like. But that's, I think that's certainly true. I think certainly a major part of what we call our psyche is our model of ourselves. I think that that part of your model of yourself is a model of what other parts of your brain are doing, parts of your brain that maybe don't themselves have a model of yourself. Like, I guess people would call it your early brain systems that are very responsive to threats and fears. And I think your cortex will build models of those brain systems. And I think that you also need a model of things that I don't know how AI will ever get a model of, like your gut and when you're hungry and you're like, I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure the goal of AI is to build something like a human, but if it is going to build something like a human, then the thing's going to need to have arms and guts like a human too, unless we give it those models.
Well, that's a question, is how human do we want AI to be? I mean, it's a really open...
That's not a question for a scientist. That's a question for an ethicist.
Yeah, sure. Sure. So, okay. Well, there's, rightly so, it seems to be a lot of excitement with grid cells lately. I mean, when you win a Nobel Prize for it, then that ushers in a lot of excitement.
That wasn't me that won the Nobel Prize, unfortunately.
When one wins a Nobel, when a Nobel Prize is won for a certain topic, that topic is going to garner some attention. And so you're doing this great work and continued success with moving forward. Tim, what's a special talent that you have that maybe not many people know about?
I can lick my nose.
We're on video. Oh my gosh, he did it, folks. And now he's not stopping. What? That was okay. Well, now we're done. Thank you very much. No.
What? Can you lick your nose?
I can stick out my tongue and touch my nose.
Can you go for it? Oh yeah, not with your tongue. Okay, good.
No. Okay. So, do you have a book that you might recommend to people to help them think effectively about these sorts of topics of neuroscience, AI, or just intelligence or cognition in general?
Yeah. So. Dayan and Abba is the best computational neuroscience book, and McKay is the best AI book. And
that's the Dayan and Abba is theoretical neuroscience.
And I can't remember what McKay called his book, but you'll find it. It's freely available online, as everything he wrote is. It's an inspirationally wonderful book. Bishop is good as well, and great, but not as good as McKay. And what's good on cognition? Well, I mean, there's loads of books about cognition. Hofstadter's fun to read.
Oh, good God. I mean, it comes up every podcast. I'm going to have to read the whole thing now.
He's fun to read.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's inspiring.
Yeah, good. Okay. So that's a lot of different answers. That's nice. Have you ever been wrong about anything?
I'm wrong about things all the time. Just ask my lab.
Anything in particular stand out that was really affected you or your career or anything?
Have I ever been wrong? You mean about a scientific position or about a lot of my ideas are wrong, but I try to not be firm in my ideas until I have evidence for them. And so I don't think I've ever been embarrassingly wrong about something, because I mean, maybe I'm embarrassingly wrong about the things I'm saying now, but mostly what I try to do in my career is report data. And it's not like I just state opinions I've never in my life just written a paper stating an opinion. And so I've definitely been wrong in what I think is going on in the brain many, many, many times, but usually before I've been wrong, I've tried to test it.
What's something that you wish that you had known going into cognitive neuroscience in general?
I don't know, man. Like, so I drifted my career. My career drifted. It drifted slowly and moved around. And I maybe, I mean, so I mean, I played with, I spent a lot of my time making data analysis algorithms for this, that, and the other, including for Formula One cars when I was a PhD student as well. And I played around with neural nets back then. But maybe if I'd this was in the age before we had fast enough computers for them. And I feel like I could have been a much richer man if I realized how powerful they would be once computers got fast. Maybe that would have been fun. It would have been useful to know about Bitcoin as well. That would have been good.
Oh, good. Yeah, yeah, sure. Okay, so what is something that you believe will come out of the interface of neuroscience and AI work that may sound crazy or counterintuitive?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess I think that the crispest ideas from AI have not been anything to do with neuroscience. But the biggest intellectual leaps in terms of the inspiration often have. I think that when Jeff Hinton was thinking about the sleep-wake algorithm, he was thinking about the brain. I think when he was thinking about convolutional neural networks, he's thinking about the brain with Leanne McKern. I think that when he probably wasn't thinking about the brain when he was designing the KL divergence to optimally organize the sleep-wake algorithm or the backprop algorithm to optimally fit his conv nets. But I think that when he was dreaming about the sort of structure of what was happening, he was thinking about the brain. And I think there are that whenever we know something definitive about the brain, it will inspire things in AI. I think that's true. And I think that of the recent big things in AI, a lot of them still have been brain inspired. So I feel like, although the really crisp thinking and the way to really make things work comes from the maths, it's difficult to have an idea with no inspiration. So I think that's what I would say.
But you're not going to speculate on anything that might sound crazy that we're going to see in 20 years or something like that.
Well, I mean, there are other types of cells that are crisp that are not in neural networks yet, like mirror neurons, for example. Mirror neurons are going to require neural networks to have models of themselves and models of how and analogies between other people and themselves, and those I guess people are going to start building neural networks that have models of neural network A that has a model of neural network B and those kinds of things. Then we'll start seeing those kinds of cells in those networks as well.
Cool. Okay, last question. What are you going to be doing 5 minutes after you hang up with me?
I'm going to speak to a colleague about a journal called eLife.
Another meeting. Another meeting. So all day. I don't miss the meetings. So anyway, yeah. Thanks for... So I appreciate you letting me stretch your time like you stretch bird necks. So thanks for taking the time with me, Tim.
It was really fun. Thanks very much indeed. Cheers. Bye.
Brain Inspired is a production of me. You can support the show through Patreon for a trifling $2 or $4 per month. Go to patreon.com/braininspired or go to the website braininspired.co and find the red Patreon button there. Your contribution will help keep this show going without any annoying advertisements like you hear on other shows. To get in touch with me, email paul@braininspired.co. The music you hear is by The New Year. Find them at thenewyear.net. Thank you for your support. See you next time. The stereo.